Hi, my name's Martin Woodward. This is how you can abuse me on Twitter if you want to. I've got my phone in my pocket, so it'll buzz away when the abuse comes in. Or if you want to send me an email after this, martin@dotnetfoundation.org. As you can tell from my accent, I'm a local lad. I live up in Belfast, bit of a blow-in. But I live in Belfast, working away on Microsoft's open source strategies. I actually work with the .NET team, part of the .NET team in Microsoft. They're based over in Redmond, in buildings sort of 25 and 44 over on the Redmond campus. But I sit and I work from my lovely field in the middle of rural Northern Ireland, which is awesome, have one of the best jobs in the world. And yeah, that is the view from where I work at home. As you know, it does rain all the time over here, but we get nice rainbows, so that's cool. Now, Microsoft do give me an office in Belfast, but there's a reason why I work from home rather than from the office, apart from obviously the hours that you have to keep when you're working with a distributed global team. So there's the view I have from my home, and then here's the view of my office. So, you know, it's a nice glamorous thing. I should do my bit for Belfast tourist information, though. It's, you know, Belfast, it's only a short ride up on the train. It's a very nice train ride. It's like £15, I think, or something, which is what? That's about €2 now, I think, according to the rate today. And, it does look a bit nicer than this now. We're kind of finished. Anyone here? Anyone? Raise your hands if you watch Game of Thrones. Do you watch Game of Thrones, anybody? Okay, cool. So Game of Thrones, that big square building there, that's Titanic Studios, and that's where Game of Thrones is actually filmed. So that's pretty cool if you want to come see it. And this museum here is the Titanic Museum, which I highly recommend. Top tourist attraction in Europe. I highly recommend you come and visit. As I say, a very cheap train ride just up the way. And don't let us worry. So that's where my office is there, just in that pointy building. In the middle of the retail park, the office park. And then, so that's where, you know, a fairly sizable chunk of Microsoft's open source strategy comes from. And then don't let this worry you. This big hole in the ground here, that's where the Titanic was built. So, you know, hope the open source thing ends better. As I like to say, where in Belfast, it was built by Irishmen, driven by an Englishman. So hey, what can possibly go wrong? Right. Microsoft's open source story actually probably started just over 12 years ago now with when we first open sourced Wix, Rob mentioning, and open sourced the Windows XML installer toolkit. And then it's carried on. We did some investments in Hadoop early in 2008. In 2011, we started partnering with Hortonworks on the Hadoop stuff. Linux, we became major Linux contributors in 2009. And then since then, it's really accelerated. I actually joined the company in 2009. I joined from a very open source focused startup, came and joined Microsoft. And one of the delightful, completely accidental things that's happened is the company has, you know, I came in thinking, oh, you know, how am I going to do in this massive company coming from a startup? And the company's transitioned sort of and worked more how I like to work anyway. You know, it's been awesome. I just had to sit there and the company's kind of come closer to me, which has been brilliant. So, and today, if you read the press reports, we have the largest commercial organization on GitHub. That's not completely true in terms of the largest company on GitHub. We're sort of, you know, competing a little bit with Google there. But all the headlines said we were the biggest, so I'll take the headlines. That's awesome. And yeah, we're very, very active. And our attitudes to Linux have changed substantially over the years as well, under the leadership of Satya. Things have certainly changed a great deal. As I say, in 2009, we really started contributing to the Linux kernel and becoming one of the major contributors to the kernel. And then in 2013 was when we started being able to have Linux VMs in our cloud in Azure. Since then, it's gone from strength to strength. We talked about introducing the Docker stuff that we've introduced. And in 2014 was when we actually started to mention, hey, you know, .NET, we're going to support that on Linux, and we're going to have that running, and we're going to build it open source. Then in April 2015, we introduced Visual Studio Code. Anyone heard about Visual Studio Code? Yep, awesome. Anyone who's using Visual Studio Code? Yay! Yay! It's awesome. It's really good. Not just for, obviously, you can do .NET development well, but it's great for TypeScript, great for Angular development, awesome for Python, all sorts of different languages. And it's a fully cross-platform, open-source editor for working, you know, on whatever platform you would like to work on. We announced we're taking PowerShell over to Linux, and obviously we launched, we had originally the Hadoop workloads were on Azure, and we introduced HD Insight on Linux back at the end of 2015 there as well. Then towards the end of 2015, it's been a busy, it was a busy year last year, we announced a big partnership with Red Hat, where actually you can get Red Hat workloads in Azure, and you can also go to Red Hat and get support from Red Hat on your Linux work. So say if you want to take a .NET workload, have it running on Red Hat and get support, you can get support from one vendor, from Red Hat, and you know, you've got one person who can answer the calls. And they're actually co-located in a support center with Microsoft people. So as far as the customer is concerned, there's a seamless transition, you know, from tier one all the way through to engineering. But we announced that as an option. And then most recently, in August, we open sourced PowerShell, and we showed the cross-platform Linux version of PowerShell that's all based on top of .NET Core, which is the thing I help look after and work on. And yeah, and then we a continuous growth of Linux workloads. Claire mentioned earlier on this morning that the momentum around Linux on Azure is huge. You know, why is Microsoft interested in Linux on Azure? Because we can, you know, we've got a business based on Linux in Azure. We can make money with Linux on Azure. So one in three VMs on Azure are running Linux. We've seen a 4x growth in the container workloads since January, all based on Docker on Linux. Yeah, it's pretty astounding statistics in terms of the amount of work that's there. Now that work, that investment doesn't just happen. You can't just take Linux and have it, you know, run in the cloud and it all magically work. There's a substantial amount of investment that goes on behind the scenes to enable this. The first thing we do is have to make Linux run really well in our cloud, make it run really well on Hyper-V, make it interoperate with all the core features, and just make sure that it's a core part of our cloud, a first-class citizen in our cloud. We then have to make sure we give full Linux support across the portfolio. So that's, you know, System Center, doing the big data, or just Hyper-V, as I was mentioning. And then more and more of our workloads, when it makes sense to run those workloads on top of Linux as a, you know, platform and as a service, we actually run those in the cloud, on Linux, fully operated, and that's how we run. To do this as well, we have to invest in making sure our, you know, all the operational interfaces work, making sure the Azure Stack stuff all works with Linux, and then invest in our Linux ecosystem. So go and get things like .NET working. Make sure you can debug from Visual Studio. If you're a .NET developer, Visual Studio, do some debugging, have it deploy in a Docker container on Linux, and do, you know, runtime deployment based on the environment it's going to be pushed into for production. You can do all that now. This is just, you know, the same sort of integration you would expect when you're doing development with our stack, when you're trying to make you as productive as possible as an engineering team, be able to do that across Windows and Linux. And what's really interesting when you see how we invest in an open source project, when you get involved with open source communities, open source communities, you know, talk is cheap. It's very easy to turn up and comment on an issue or send an email saying, yeah, I think it should work like this, you know, and I think it should work like that. Open source communities value contribution over everything else, value code over everything else. And if you turn up and you're regularly contributing code, then you become part of that community. You have influence in that community. You have a say in how that community works. One of the areas where I've been really pleased to see our progress is actually improving the performance. Now, a lot of this work is driven purely, completely out of self-interest from Microsoft's point of view. You know, we want Linux to run really well on Azure, but actually, we want Linux to run really well because we're always looking at our COGS, our cost of goods sold. So when we're trying to sell you services in Azure, we sell it you for one price, and then we're trying to always make it cheaper and cheaper for us to run in the back end so we can improve margins and then be able to reduce the price and pass those savings on to you. So by doing some deep investments in the Linux kernel, we're actually able to improve the performance of Linux on Azure, but also we have to improve the performance of Linux everywhere on bare metal. If we don't do that, then people wouldn't accept any of our contributions. We have to increase performance across the board, and we have been. So that's awesome to see. And it's not just Linux as well. We're contributing actively to FreeBSD. We're contributing both in terms of making sure it can run really well on Hyper-V, because we have a lot of FreeBSD-based workloads in Azure. But we also are on the FreeBSD Foundation and trying to get more involved in that community. We're increasingly involved in Cloud Foundry and helping out over there, especially with the commercial Cloud Foundry side, and working with the Bosch work and trying to get all that integrated in. And then finally, over on the OpenStack side, we partner with cloud-based solutions to get cloud-based working really well. But we also, for the cloud-based community side, we contribute there with resources. It turns out we have a lot of servers kicking around in cupboards in Microsoft and things. We can go and get 200 servers and use that to be the CI build system for Azure, for OpenStack, and help make that open source community function better as a community because we need it to, because we want to go run it in our cloud. Okay, now's the point where I seamlessly transition from WIM slides into my own slides, so I hope you probably not notice this bit. I now get to talk about my favorite topic, which is me and the stuff I talk about. So I work on the .NET Foundation, and that's an open source foundation that's been set up to provide a vendor-neutral platform, a vendor-neutral space for innovation and collaboration around .NET, another important open source investment we have. And that's all the projects you kind of, Mono and .NET Core, Roslyn, but also projects like XUnit and the Worldwide Telescope. Open Live Writer is a project in the .NET Foundation that was done by a group of volunteers, and actually we managed to make it open source and get it out there. So we have a load of projects over there, and we provide help and support and collaboration for these projects inside the .NET Foundation. And as well as Microsoft, there are a group of companies that come together to help steer the platform, the .NET platform, to make sure it goes in a way that works for everybody. So Red Hat is a huge partner, along with Samsung, Unity, a great help there. Don't know if Pokemon Go, that's .NET open source is in Pokemon Go. It's, if you go to the About screen, you can see a thing for JSON.NET, which probably a lot of the .NET developers here know and use. It's all based on open source .NET in the client. JetBrains with their Project Rider, and obviously with all their work in the .NET space. So we have all these communities working together, help us with .NET. Now, when we open sourced .NET, it made a lot of news. It was quite funny. That same day, we landed a robot on a rock like 320 million miles away. And .NET being open sourced was the number one tracking news item, which was pretty awesome. It was quite good trying to keep a website up under that kind of load. But it made news. It was big news. Whenever that sort of news comes out, I always get the same sort of questions. We open source X. We open source Y. Windows Movie Maker. We open source Microsoft Bob, in this instance, in case for the young people didn't recognize what that was. So, and the answer is no, we won't be open. I don't think we'll be open sourcing Microsoft Bob. It doesn't really fit into the strategy. We don't open source stuff just because we don't want it anymore. We open source stuff because we do want it, because we are trying to actively invest in it and build a community around it. And there are three major areas where open source fits into the strategy here at Microsoft. So the first one is when you're trying to collaborate on a product. So I work with the .NET team. Trying to get people to use the latest versions of .NET is incredibly hard work. You know, people like to stick with the version they've got because they know it works. Trying to get them to use the very, very, very latest is really hard. So trying to get feedback on the very latest versions of .NET is very hard. Now, we're trying to do a lot of stuff to make this easier. So with .NET Core, when you upgrade your version of .NET, you actually just can upgrade it for that one app, for that one workload. You don't have to upgrade it for the whole server, which makes a deployment of microservices based on .NET a lot easier, because now you can upgrade .NET versions with an application upgrade, and if anything goes wrong, just roll back, and your box has not been touched at all. So we've done stuff there. But by being open source, it allows us as a developer team to be a lot more agile, because now we can get instant feedback, not just on, you know, suggestions and specifications, but instant feedback on actual bits. There's a bleeding edge of developers that take the upstream version and run with it actively and give us real feedback. And that allows us to change and pivot and make sure that what we're going to deliver is actually what our customers need and be responsive, rather than having to wait for the first version to ship, wait for the first round of feedback, adjust and ship again, and by that time, you know, 3 years has passed. That's no good. Need to be agile. The same's true with TypeScript and Chakra. Chakra's the JavaScript engine that came from IE and is now used quite widely. And TypeScript's gone from, it's a type-safe JavaScript, and it's gone to be one of the most popular languages on GitHub in no time at all. That wouldn't have happened if TypeScript hadn't have been open source. And it, again, allows us to collaborate and work on tools that we were going to work on anyway, and allows us to be more agile with them. The second place we use open source is in terms of allowing us to distribute more widely. So, for example, Visual Studio Code is a great example there, where we want Visual Studio Code to be everywhere. We want Visual Studio Code to be on the Mac. We want Visual Studio to be on Windows. We want Visual Studio Code to be able to go into upstream distributions of Linux, so that then it can go into downstream versions of Linux and be everywhere. You can, if you do that by being open source, then it allows Visual Studio Code to be shipped with other open source things, and it allows it also for people to build on top of Visual Studio Code, which is what we want. And then the same is also true with obviously things like SDKs and, you know, application insights, places where we make money on a service by making the code that talks to our service open source, then we can just increase the potential audience for our service even more. And then the final area is one we were talking about earlier with Linux, is where we're actually collaborating with an existing ecosystem, and we're collaborating with other companies. So Linux is a great example where we've been, you know, there are, you know, hundreds of people actively working in Microsoft to make Linux awesome. There are, Git was one I was strongly involved with when we introduced that into the company as well. Again, we had to become contributors and help out with the Git ecosystem so that then we could build Git into Visual Studio. Git's a source control system for the managers here and things. I'm not just, you know, swearing at you. We can integrate that into Visual Studio. We can integrate that into Visual Studio Team Services and into Team Foundation Server. But we don't want to take a key strategic bet on a key technology like that if we don't have any influence in how that platform's going to go. And we can't influence the platform if we're not contributing. So that's why we contribute to these open source projects, really. It's purely in our own self-interest, but it benefits all. And as Ben talked about this morning as well, Docker's another area where we've been closely working with that community. Now, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the .NET journey and the journey that we went on with .NET, open sourcing it, because we actually been doing this for a while. And I found it quite interesting in the similarities that we'd gone through with open sourcing .NET that we've done with other things before and after. And it's also interesting to me how much quicker we're getting at going through like a maturity curve. Go through the .NET journey. I see the same journey happen with something like Chakra, apart from it happened a lot quicker. .NET took years, probably 2008, 2009, I think, was when we first started seriously talking about open sourcing .NET. And, you know, it took a long time. And then, you know, Chakra, it was like April we started seriously talking about it. And then it was the end of the year when we actually did open source it. So the only way to get good at something is to practice. And Microsoft being able to get good and understand how to work with open source communities, understanding how open source fits into its business model, we're just getting better at it and getting quicker. So the .NET journey, as I say, is a small step for a software company, a giant leap for a company that makes all its money from IP, basically. We have one of the largest IP portfolios in the world, you know. So it was something that we had to do and had to get good at. With .NET, the first thing we did, and the first thing that's a big emotional step, is to make the source open, to make it publicly viewable. Now, with .NET, it was done in a couple of different ways, kind of, you know, half ways, because we always kind of wanted to make it open source, but never actually managed to do it properly. So to begin with, there was certain things available. Then we had the reference license where you could read the source, but you couldn't use the source. So we made the source available. That first step is a huge emotional leap for your engineers. You wouldn't believe the amount of conversations I have with teams where they're like, oh, I really want to open source this, but I'm just going to refactor the code for a year because it's really messy and I don't want everybody seeing my code while it looks like this, you know. To which my answer is, hang on a minute, aren't there like a billion people on the planet using this code already? You know, I think it should already kind of be refactored and work well, you know, ship it. If it's already out there, ship the code. Maybe take the swear words out, but ship the code. Then with .NET, what we did is kind of opened up the process by which we designed the language. So we have the ECMA standards committee for the C# language, and we wanted to kind of open that up, make it more interactive, again, to get early feedback so that we could course correct and be more agile. So we started off doing that, but that was just at the design stage. You could comment and you could, you know, help us with designing the language, but you couldn't really touch it. You could just, you know, provide feedback. The next thing that we did was actually then go open source under a real open source license. So we released the source open. We pushed it out. It was on Copex at the time, then moved on to GitHub. But the interesting thing was we were kind of publishing to open source. It was under a permissive open source license. So, you know, a license which allowed people to actually use it for what they want, whatever they wanted to do. But the team themselves were working away in Team Foundation Server and Visual Studio Team Services. They weren't actually out there all the time in the community. They used to do their engineering work, publish it open, and then any comments that came in from the open source community, they'd have to come in a different way and get manually kind of merged in and adjusted. And, you know, it was just people wanting to keep the same control and not quite sure how they're going to work. The huge leap that we had to take as a team was to go from working on our own engineering systems where we've built up, you know, decades of engineering debt. You would think if you walk into a software project in Microsoft, you could walk up to it, you know, press F5 in Visual Studio and go to the bin folder and there's magic there and you can just run Word. That's not how it works, you know. Microsoft has been around a long, long time. With .NET, you know, we had to be able to build Visual Studio and .NET before Visual Studio and .NET existed. So there was a whole set of bootstrap tools, and there was a whole bunch of stuff that had to get done to remove the funky Microsoftness about the code and actually make it be code you could go into Visual Studio and press F5, or code you could go to the command line on Linux and type make and it build. So once we did that, and we could get fully open source, we then moved the whole team over to GitHub. So all of the engineers in my team work full-time on .NET in GitHub. And that's the model the preferred model for open source projects in Microsoft now. PowerShell team, the TypeScript team. If you're an open source team in Microsoft, which there are many now, you work in the open on GitHub. If you want to do a code change and you sit down the corridor from somebody else on the team, you still have to go to GitHub, send what's called a pull request, over to the project with your change in it, and that's the point of code review. And that's the same process any of you people would want to do. If you wanted to come in and make a change to the Roslyn, which is the compiler that sits underneath .NET, if you wanted to make a change to it, you would go in and do a pull request as well. So our engineering team follow the same processes, have the same visibility that anybody in the community could do it. We democratized contributing to .NET. And when we did that, we saw a huge, huge uptake, and I'll show you some stats on the levels of contribution into the platform. So that was really the big leap, and it was a leap of faith. We hadn't done it before with such a big project, with such a valuable project to the company, with a project that ships in Windows, you know, it was a big deal. And there was lots of meetings with lawyers and managers and people, and took a lot of, you know, persuading, but we got there, and it's been a phenomenal success. Now, once you're out there and you're open, you think, ta-da, I've done it. Turns out, no. Because while you've maybe got the code out there and everybody can contribute now, yeah, great. If you go into your company, you probably have access to a lot of source control in your company. You couldn't walk up to some random team's code and make a change. You know, A, you don't have the skills, and B, you're probably not going to do it right, or you're not going to do what the team want. So what we then had to do, and what we quickly found we had to do, was improve our docs, improve our documentation. A lot of the documentation was, you know, had been around for a long, long time. It was all in internal Word documents or internal wikis, or didn't exist at all. It was just tribal knowledge. And we had to take that knowledge and make it open. We had to take the Book of Runtime, which was this book, you know, got handed down from generation to generation of these bearded, you know, neck-bearded compiler developers that would, you know, pass it on to the next generation. We had to take the Book of Runtime and put it online and make it so if we want to make a change to our documentation, again, somebody sends a pull request, somebody contributes a change, and we review that change and we update it. Just we make it as open as the code. And it actually isn't just the documentation. We have a weekly stand-up that we do, and we put onto Channel 9 and on YouTube that explains, you know, where we're up to and like keep on track of things. We put any training documentation we're doing to the team. We did Git training when we moved over to Git, distributed version control, from Team Foundation server, Team Foundation version control. That training course we put online. You know, meetings where we're doing design reviews, put them online. And just generally make sure all of the assets of the project are open and anyone can contribute to. You don't have to have a blue badge and be in the club to contribute. And then finally, the last emotional step that needs to go to is actually to properly share ownership, to properly allow somebody who doesn't work from Microsoft to have commit rights on a project. Now, they have to earn that trust. You know, they have to work and get to the point where the engineers just consider them as, you know, smarter than them, which takes a lot with a lot of engineers I work with, you know, to impress them. But hey, I definitely don't. They just delete all my code. And they actually be able to share that ownership. And sometimes we have to change things in the process to be able to share ownership. So for instance, recently we took Reactive Extensions, RX.NET, and we took that and we shipped that in things like Entity Framework. But we wanted the main project leads of Reactive Extensions, so Brendan Foster and Oren Novotny, we wanted them to take over ownership. Now, they work for different companies. One works at GitHub, one's a consultant in the US. And we wanted them to be able to take ownership of it, but still ship it as part of the core thing. So we actually did that by changing how we signed that little bit of code. And rather than signing the bit of code that ships with a Microsoft AuthentiCode signature, you know, get signed with a .NET Foundation AuthentiCode signature. And it's just little things of process sometimes you have to do. But the major thing is the emotional step of letting somebody else work with your, you know, your baby. And if you don't let people in, if you don't give people a sense of shared ownership, if you're not willing to make that change, then there's a limit as to how much contribution you'll get from people. So I mentioned when we made the leap, we saw a huge change. In the first month, when we went from being, you know, source open to working live, open source. There was a huge increase in the amount of pull requests we were accepting and the amount of issues, and a huge increase in the number of forks we were getting per month. Not just, you know, one and a bit to eight, but every month it started increasing. Now, when we take teams and we make them open, at Microsoft, we're a very, very, very data-driven company. You probably get from Satya and Brad, you don't win arguments by saying, I think X or I think Y. You win arguments and you get permission to do something by showing data. So we track data with a lot of things. It's just what we do. It's how we work. And one of the things that we do is actually track the responsiveness of teams. We found that the responding to somebody's pull, so when somebody submits you code, a pull request, when somebody sends that code over to you, we found that the responsiveness is vitally important to ensuring that code then goes on to get merged. And that makes sense. If you've, you know, I've contributed to open source projects before that I've not been that a member of yet. Your first contribution, you really sweat it. You know, you run over tests, you like spell check everything, you go over every semicolon, you go over all the code formatting. You know, this is like, you know, I'm gonna contribute to .NET. You know, it's a big thing. So you put a lot of effort into it. You send the pull request off, you send the code change off to the open source project. And then I've done this myself. I've sat there, you know, just watched it. And like F5 in the browser, even though GitHub has, you know, it polls the page to tell you when something happened, you still F5 it anyway, because surely somebody must have looked at it by now, you know. And you'll sit there, and if somebody doesn't look at this pull request for a month, even if it's the most awesome piece of code, they come back and go, yep, looked at it, you know, why is this doing this? Why is this doing that? Can you change this? Can you change that? Often, we'd see a big drop-off the longer that you leave it to contributing. And that just makes sense, because the developer is no longer sat there waiting, hitting F5 on the browser. They've moved off. They've gone and done another thing. You know, they've solved this problem already. It's not in their main mind anymore. You've got to get them to context switch again and think about that pull request, and that's just hard work. So responsiveness is very, very important, and we try and get that up. And you see, here's some of the numbers we achieved, and you know, this is what some of the sorts of stats that we track. Does it work? Turns out it does. With .NET Core, we're seeing a year-on-year growth now of 60% in terms of active .NET developers, and that's active .NET developers. That's developers who are actively using, actively developing on .NET, not just, you know, call themselves .NET developers. So we're seeing a, you know, growth year-on-year in terms of .NET. We're seeing 40% of .NET Core, which is our cross-platform, you know, new shiny version of .NET. 40% of people that pick up .NET Core and start coding with it have never coded in .NET before. That's awesome. That's brilliant news for us. So this is working really well. And the thing that impresses the bosses at Microsoft when you come to it is that graph there going up is showing you the numbers of contributions that have come into Core CLR and Core FX, which are the two main projects in .NET. It's the amount of contributions that come from people who don't have Microsoft.com in their email. And it's 62% now of the change that goes into .NET comes from people outside of Microsoft. So, you know, that's awesome in terms of the amount of influence and co-ownership we have over the .NET framework. And then when I'm selling it to managers and go, look, you know, hey, we're getting 62% free development. Now, it really isn't free, because you've still got to code review things, you've got to test things, you've got to merge things, you've got to integrate. It still takes work, and it probably takes more work. But the fact is, we're getting a huge amount of involvement from the community, and that's just amazing to see. And it's great to see the spread of the work as well. So in 2005, you know, this is a chart which shows the value of contributions over region, and we have this magic metric which we use to calculate value on based on what you've contributed into .NET. And that was in 2015. Sorry, in 2016, boom, you know? And it's just showing no signs of slowing down. It's fascinating to see. C# has risen up the charts in terms of GitHub, in terms of popularity, which, again, is important for everybody here who does .NET development, even if you don't do open source .NET, because the more visible .NET is to the ecosystem, the more people are going to be picking up .NET, the more .NET community we have, the more ecosystem we have, the better it is for you to be able to build applications, because you can go and assemble your new line of business application from a bunch of open source building blocks. Now, when you're building code out in the open, it's not a free lunch. You know, it doesn't just, it's not all shiny roses and, you know, kumbaya. It's sort of, there are some tensions, and I thought it was worth talking about those, especially for people here who are thinking about how can I get my company more involved in contributing to open source themselves or doing stuff in open source. It's not for free. There are certain tensions that happen as we're building a product as big as .NET in the open. The first one is when you is trying to maintain a product direction. With all these different parties, all these different people wanting to get involved, how do you still have that clear direction, that clear vision about where you want to go to as a platform and as a framework? And that's always been one of the strengths of .NET as well, is, you know, it's quite opinionated and it's able to just go, yep, this is how we want to do it. This is how we want to do generics. This is how we want to do async. You know, it can just go and do those things. So we need to maintain the product direction. Initially, we used to publish design notes as issues on GitHub, and we send out the meeting notes, and we'd get lots of comments in those meeting notes. And, you know, there'd be a lot of, like, plus ones and things, and there'd be a lot of sort of random stuff, because, again, this, like, I don't know, how a scalar function should work in blah, 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 or how compilers should work with field programmable arrays and all this stuff. That's stuff that people like, you know, people have opinions on late at night. Not always do they need to actually go make a business or actually go do the work in coding them. Opinions are cheap. You know, it's we actually have to go do something with them. So the signal to noise ratio on some of those comments wasn't awesome. So then what we did instead is we moved to having very clear roadmaps for each project that say, hey, this is where the project's going. This is what we're going to work on next. And when we want to make a change to that roadmap, we send a pull request. We send a code review of the change of the roadmap to the roadmap document. And then people can comment on the change. And, you know, do they think this is a good idea? Do they think that's a good idea? People can submit their own changes if they wish, you know. And it allows us to have a bit more clarity as to if you want to know what the roadmap is right now, this is where you go. So it's a lot clearer. The next tension that we have is around the different types of contributors we have working on .NET. As I mentioned, 62% of the people working in .NET don't work at Microsoft now. That's 62% of people who are working on .NET in their own time or quite often for their company. They have their own reasons for working on .NET. They have their own deadlines, their own motivations. And then you've got the people, you know, who are salaried, who need a certain ship it date and they need to do this. One of the things, you know, you quite often run into when you first start working fully open is you need to hack something in because it's midnight, we're shipping tomorrow at 6 a.m., I've got to get this change in by 2 a.m., I don't care how rough it is, I just need to get it in and get it working so we can ship the product. And you send the pull request off, and then you get somebody commenting about, yeah, that'd be quite nice if you refactored this into the factory pattern, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, I don't care, I need to ship it, you know. So you've got this tension that exists. Sometimes that can work in our favor. The original plan with the .NET framework was let's open source it as, and let's say we're going to open source it as cross-platform, but we're going to do all that work actually in the open. We didn't go, ta-da, it's done. We did it with the community. We involved the community, and we did it in the open. So the first version of .NET that was shipped open source wasn't actually cross-platform. You know, it had some of the bits in there, but it wasn't finished. Within 4 days of us actually putting .NET open, Jeff Smith, Kangaroo was down there. Yeah, he turned up and just went, here you go, it works on the Mac now. We had like a team who were telling us that was going to take 9 months of like, you know, six people or six people, 9 months. It's always one of those, isn't it, when you're just pulling an estimate out of the air. And, you know, it's going to take a long time to do. And he just, one guy, you know, basically over a weekend, turned it around and delivered OS X support, which is pretty amazing. Now, it does help that, A, he is like a genius. B, he did a lot of work on mono previously, so kind of knew all this stuff and done all this already before. So giving him the real source code rather than him having to figure out how it all worked was like the gift from heaven. So he was like, oh, you know, he couldn't resist. He couldn't not do it because it was just so easy now compared to how it had been before. But that was amazing. That was just an amazing gift. Sometimes, though, you get contributions that, again, aren't entirely on the roadmap. When I open-sourced Open Live Writer, somebody came along and fixed all the spelling mistakes for me in the source code of Open Live Writer, which is awesome. And it's actually quite a common first pull request is to fix a typo. And it's kind of testing out, you know, testing out your contribution, make sure you know how to contribute to the project. One typo here or there is fine, low risk. But this guy, bless him, he'd gone and fixed thousands of typos, thousands of spelling mistakes, and come in and, you know, it touched every single file. And this is why we're trying to get this thing shipped, you know, and we'd have had to, like, merge those changes with everything else. And so for this one, we're like, you know, sorry, you know, thanks. I really appreciate it. That's awesome of you. Thank you very much. But we can't really take this right now because it's a huge change to the code. It doesn't really give any end user value, you know, if a variable's spelt correctly. They're never going to see it. And it's quite hard to explain to people sometimes because, if a variable's spelt wrong, it's a defect, it's a bug, you know, it's wrong. How can you not want to fix it? And you're like, well, it doesn't give any value to the customer fixing it and introduces a heck of a lot of risk. So, sorry, no, wasn't on the roadmap, and we'll leave it, we'll park it, but we're not going to merge that right now. Sorry about that. And you have to handle those conversations, you know, nicely and be friendly and help out. Where we've come and we're using this elsewhere is there was a bunch of unit tests we had for Link that we had, and we knew they were good and we had value in them. We just didn't have time to port them over to XUnit. They were originally written in NUnit, wanted them in XUnit and moved over. So we had the source code there. We just, you know, we're like, here are the tests. We put in a to-do, basically. We really, really, really would like to take all of these unit tests and have them converted over and running within this project. We're just going to do the basics for now and, like, leave these here. And we marked it as up for grabs. If you want to come and do this, great. We'll get to it eventually, but we're not going to be doing it right now. But if you want to do something, great. And somebody just turned up again in a weekend, wrote a program which did the conversion for us, and then sent us a code. So again, that was great. And that was a really good change that happened, again, because we indicated where we would like help. The final biggest challenge when it comes to working with open source projects is your team is now globally distributed. There's no way around it. And that's one of the reasons why I do my job from a field in the middle of Ireland is because it forces teams I'm working with to actually now have to communicate asynchronously, communicate electronically, live some of the pain themselves of working in a distributed, globally distributed fashion. And it's not distance that's the problem, it's time zones. It's those delays in communication and the not being able to just get around a whiteboard and fix something. And I wish I could tell you, look, there's an amazing, easy answer for fixing massively globally distributed teams. Turns out there isn't. There's lots of little things. Nothing quite replaces standing around a whiteboard. Even electric, you know, even Surface Hub, awesome that it is. And OneNote, awesome that it is. You can sort of draw things on it and talk about it. It still doesn't replace sitting in a room with somebody around a whiteboard. It's not the same kind of level of bandwidth of communication with that person. So, you know, there's lots of things you can do, recording videos, making sure you write up notes, having discipline around communication, but it's still distributed teams are hands down the hardest bit to solve, but the thing you need to solve and the thing you're forced to solve once you go open source. So, there's tensions of open development. But when you do develop in the open, you also have to foster your community, bring your community up around you. So I went round and I asked the team, you know, hey, how do we go about fostering community? What do we do to get community? So I got some answers, which have not come through very well. There we go, that's exciting. Be a role model, you know, provide feedback, whatever. Summarized, I always think, by Bill and Ted's excellent advice, be awesome to each other, you know. just be nice. And there's a reason why you need to be nice. There's a reason why you need to be helpful and responsive. And the way I like to talk about this is to imagine a contribution funnel. Contribution funnel. So 99.999999% of people who come and use your open source project are just going to take the open source project and run away and use it and never come back. That's fine. That's what happens. It just does. So what you've got to accept that. A small percentage of the people will come back and they will contribute time to you. They will want to contribute time. They'll want to be able to give you an issue, give you a bug, give you write a blog post that explains how to use your project, go to a user group and talk about this awesome new open source library they've got and how they used it in their project and they've had lots of success. All of these things are gifts of time that people are giving you to your project. You need to cultivate those. How do you cultivate those? Well, give good documentation, give good getting started guidance, give a README that clearly explains how to contribute to the project, make the source code really easy to find, all those sorts of things. So you've got to understand that you're going to have, you know, a big breadth of users and only a small amount of those are going to contribute. Try and make it as easy as possible and then try and widen the user base as much as possible and get as many people exposed to your application as possible. And then a small percentage of those that contribute time will come back and actually give you gifts of code, will give you pull requests, will fix a bug, not just tell you about a bug, but provide you with a fix. How do you do that? You do that by being nice in issues. You do that by, you know, not leaving snarky comments and not going, meh. You do that by actually saying, actually, that's a good point. You know, fair point. I would love to fix that, but this is the reason why we're not fixing it right now. But that's really good. Yep, thanks. Or, you know, or this is why we're not looking at that now. Or, yeah, I know you want C-sharp to no longer be statically typed, but turns out we really, really want C-sharp to be statically typed. So, sorry, no, that issue's, you know, close that off. And by being clear like that, you pull people down to contribute code. And then finally, by being responsive to people contributing code, by nurturing the people who give you code, you then eventually can nurture somebody to the point where they are an expert on that code. They know the code as well as every engineer on that team and can be co-owner of that code. Another important thing is just to have fun. So one of the things we do every now and then is like send out presents. You know, we have stickers. If people want stickers, so, you know, you can get some stickers of different projects. But we also send out thank you gifts every now and then to say thanks to people for contributing to different projects. Last year we did a cup of tea. So we sent out a mug to people with cup of tea. The coders here will find that hilarious. Managers, not so much. Coders, that's the funniest joke you've ever seen. So we sent that out to people. Here you go. Here's awesome. And we actually, Casey on the team went down and took the SHA-1, the commit ID of the commit, and laser etched it into their mug, hand laser etched it, if that's such a possible thing, and before we posted it out. And these are just really, really cool. And, you know, just send them out to people. Thanks, you know, handwritten note, thanks for your contribution. And just little things like that have a huge amount of value in terms of, you know, nurturing a community, building a community. It helps as well when we come in and we slip in little Easter eggs into launch videos. So we give Scott Guthrie one of the cup of tea mugs, you know, and slipped in as a little Easter egg. So anyone that got one was like, wow, I had that. There we go. Not that Scott Good writes as much code as he used to, but he still writes a little bit, which is quite scary. And when you do this, amazing things happen. As I mentioned, Pokemon Go. Oh, my kids are playing this thing, and I go into the About box, and it's using JSON.net. I'm like, hang on a minute, and it's using Unity. I'm like, this is using my stuff. And my kids think I'm awesome now, because they're like, wow, this is stuff you work on. You helped make Pokemon Go. Well, no, not really. And, you know, no, I can't make a whatever it is appear in whatever, I don't even know, whatever, they, or make one evolve into such and such. You can write a really good Pokemon Go robot in C#. Turns out there's loads of those, but don't, because you'll get banned. But yeah, so you get all these unexpected gifts that come along. The classic thing that always happens and is an epiphany that developers get is, you know, they get some random contribution that comes in. David Fowler, who's one of the devs on the ASP.NET team, incredibly smart guy. And I love that post. He did that recently where he's like, we're doing a lot of work on the performance of Kestrel and .NET Core. The performance numbers are just out of this world amazing. You know, it's like 8 times faster than Node and 4 times faster than Go. It's really, really fast. And an optimization came in, and you know, David was saying, I have no idea what a Debrecen table is. And like, he's smart. He would know what one of those is. You know, it's some serious computer science going on. You get gifts of code like that. You also get things we never even expected. The Peach Pie project took the Roslyn compiler and used that to compile PHP code to run in IL on top of a CLR. And the performance numbers they're getting on top of .NET Core are just astounding. Like, you see a bar chart between, you know, PHP native and then compiled on top of .NET, and you can't even see the .NET on the bar chart. The axes are so messed up. It's amazing the performance they're getting. Totally didn't expect them to do that. It's brilliant. I mentioned JetBrains. They have Project Rider, which is basically IntelliJ. You know, Java developers here will know what IntelliJ is. It's their JetBrains IDE. Well, they're basically taking JetBrains, taking IntelliJ, and making it work with C#, making it work with .NET Core. And that, again, built using Mono, built using Roslyn, built using open source .NET. All this is possible because of these things being open source and available under a permissive license. One my son uses is Continuous, which is an open source, which is an IDE for the iPad to do C# code. It's mad. And you just go in and like type. They've even got Edit and Continue working, which we still haven't quite got figured out in Visual Studio, which is quite frustrating. But it's just brilliant. It's just, you know, and again, because of it all being open source, it's just fantastic. So we led a culture change in Microsoft. It wasn't easy. We had to do a lot of education. We had to do a lot of process and tooling to enable this. But by doing these culture changes, by having a big, conscious change of culture inside of the company, led from the very top, but with support all the way up from engineering, we're able to change the culture inside Microsoft to the point now where somebody like Anders comes in and he has a better commit graph than I do, which is quite frustrating. Anders is a proper genius, you know, and he's working in the open on GitHub contributing code. And you had really won, and you had really succeeded. So Microsoft's still a very email-centric culture. Even with Yammer and things, we still have a lot of email in the company. And, you know, usual things happen when somebody emails. They send out, you know, if they have a baby, obligatory baby pictures get emailed around the team. And the best one I saw recently, somebody sent out a baby picture. The very first reply that came back from the baby picture was, +1, looks good to merge, which I thought was great. I knew we'd won. So how do you get involved? Well, go over to .NET on GitHub, check us out, get involved. Feel free to contribute with the ongoing design of .NET. More importantly, contribute or start your own .NET open source project. Learn how to contribute to open source projects and contribute to your own open source projects. Help your company contribute. And to show you some of the, again, some of the magic things that are possible with contribution, I just wanted to leave you with one more video that'll really show you some of the amazing, wonderful things that can happen once we start getting involved with open source.
We are pushing the boundaries of what is possible through technology. Without it, I would not be able to speak to you today.
He was down to about a word a minute.
Every time he needed to access his machine, open files, surf the web, all of these actions were very, very tedious because he had to rely on a mouse, which was really very hard for someone who doesn't have an ability to move a mouse. We wanted to build a more open platform that allowed us to really quickly configure and change things so that we're constantly iterating and trying. Bring in different word predictors, bring in different sensors, change the UI, do all of these things by way of just maybe changing XML files rather than doing a lot of coding.
The system is written using Visual Studio, C#. We use standard Windows Forms, .NET 4.5. We also use some WPF. And we use the standard Microsoft pluggable framework paradigm to load all the DLLs at runtime. Everything was built around this one actuation mechanism where he uses his cheek to trigger the system. The system responds.
And we collected hours and hours of footage of just his face, of him interacting with the system. What was the range of his motion? Did it change with the time of the day? When he was tired, you want the system to trigger, you want the software interface to work.
We iterated a lot with him being as a key designer, and the minute he started using it, he would find something. And then he'll come back to us and you know, he'll have this like huge smile on his face. His access to many of the common functions in his machine was about a 10x improvement. Steven was actually quite adamant about open sourcing the system. The nice thing about having such an open platform is that really people from different areas of research and development can really make a huge impact. So please help us. We can't wait to see what your contributions will bring to the world of disabilities.
I challenge you all here to excel, to bring about the changes you want in the world. Keep pushing and never give up.
Thank you very much. I can't wait to see what you contribute, and thank you for your time.